It is a great idea for a film, and this is my kind of movie, where there's an ethical dilemma that you have to sort of resolve. And the fact that there's science fiction involved means, you know, you can sort of play with an idea that's not here yet. But what if it was? And here's the idea. What if there was a company that could make a believable clone of you, and you realized that you had a deadly disease, you were going to survive, and you wanted to seamlessly provide for your family some way to keep going as if you never left. But you can't tell them that this is a clone. It's all very hush-hush. So you have to make this decision about whether realistic version of you would, first of all, trick your family. And would you want to put them in the situation of, you know, your clone kind of going on after you have passed? Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Sing 2 and Swan Song, starting with Sing 2, which I don't know how you feel about these kinds of movies, Mike, but, you know, to me, I can always sit down and watch a movie like this. I love Sing 1. You know, I knew before I even watched Sing 2 that I was going to like it. It reminds me of those old Judy Garland, Andy Rooney movies. You know, let's put on a show. I mean, that's the pretext. At some point you need, you know, to bring in all the music and bring all the characters together in spite of some sort of adversity. And this one, I think, does not disappoint. It's like Glee with animated animals. What do you think, Mike?
Marie, it actually has been described as an animated jukebox musical, and it has that quality. But like you, in terms of film history, sure, I think about Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney, hey kids, let's put on a show. And oftentimes, it's one of the most venerable of, you know, musical comedy premises. And the thing about it that makes it work as a premise is just simply, you know, it's not pretentious. It's just very basic. You know, let's get the gang together, whatever challenges we have, we're going to put on the show. There's usually some worthy cause. In the first Sing, it was that the town theater had gone bankrupt. And, you know, let's put on a show, let's raise money, let's save it, and so on. So there's that kind of rooting interest in it. And because it's not that much of a storyline per se, the jukebox musical aspect is you can add whatever you want, basically, you know, whatever musical comedy numbers or routines. The first one I enjoyed. I've got to say, I didn't enjoy the second one as much. One reason would just simply be overfamiliarity. And in fact, one of the reviews that I read described the second one, which we're talking about, as all glitz and no substance. That might be a little harsh, but I agree with it fundamentally, in the sense that in the first one, you really are trying to save, or they're trying to save, the town theater. There you go, small town ethics, if you will. The second one has the same basic storyline, really. You've got to put on a show, got to raise money, this and that. But the ambiance, the setting is different. Unlike the first one with that small town theater, this time they go to a city, a fictitious city, but it's basically Las Vegas. So, you know, they've got to put on a show, but now everything gets ramped up, or amped up, if you will. And for my money, the second film is also longer than the first, only by about 10 or 15 minutes, but enough where I feel like, you know, I know this story. I had it in the first one. Here we go again. It's the reset button, right? And to me, although I enjoyed this sequel, to me, it was so busy and so bright and so relentless that I thought, oh, jeepers, give me a break. You know, like either slow down, relax, do something more, something different. And it just keeps going that way. But it is, you know, my reaction fundamentally was that it is enjoyable, like scene by scene. It did sort of wear me out after a while. But I just thought, like, you know, if you're going to Las Vegas, I guess you got to go big, right? And this sequel definitely goes big that way. How do you feel about that? Because it actually does kind of amplify or ramp up the basic story elements from the first one.
I think you're absolutely correct about that. I think, though, that it hews to that sort of formula that kids' movies often do. If you think about Disney movies in particular, there's, you know, underlying thread of a storyline. And from time to time, you break from the storyline for a song, which makes sense organically or not, but you get the songs in there anyway, because that's just the way those go. It kind of strikes me that kids are more open to the idea of a musical than adults. At some point, adults seem to get tired of the, let's throw a song in there every 10 minutes or so, and sort of move away from that, unless it's billed as a musical. And then, you know, you either watch it because you like them, or you don't watch it because you don't like musicals. But with kids' movies, it's almost expected that there's going to be some songs in it to carry you know, the interest throughout the movie. And I think that when you take the situation with Sing and Sing 2, what you have is a situation where they're performers, first of all. So then you just need some sort of pretext to get them to put on the show. So I give it some leeway for that, because that's the whole point. I mean, that's why you make these movies, because kids like music and the storylines in it about, you know, stage fright or having to do something that really scares you or what you need to do to be a team player. You know, these are all good messages that underlie the story.
You make a really good point. And I smiled when you mentioned how in a film like this, there's the thread of a story, the hint of narrative to tie together the musical numbers. And of course, that's a given in so many musicals throughout Hollywood history. But mentally, I was playing games with the expression. And I was thinking, well, is it a thread of a story or a threat of a story? In other words, no, because sometimes in a film like this, you wonder, are you better off with trying to flesh it out and give it a full story? You're better off just saying, hey, it's a musical variety show. We go from one to the next. And that of course, is very dependent on the particular film you're talking about. But let me pick up on something else you mentioned. Of course, musicals have always been like this. And in terms of animated musicals, you're absolutely right. Kids love to have those musical numbers put in there. They don't have some of the questions that adults might have, as in, why are these people now singing and dancing? Or where's the story? They don't have as much of a worry that way. But my question isn't so much on that as on this. Namely, that even though animated musicals have always had this kind of structure, I'm wondering, in a case like Sing 2, to me, it seems to be a sort of hyperdrive, if you will. It really pushes that. And the question through that is this. Do you think in some ways, because of our culture, let's call it music video oriented culture, because of these quick, short, flashy grabs, if you will, here's 3 minutes of song, you know, and then bam, here's another 3 minutes. Do you think, if anything, all that's been kind of ratcheted up or ramped up in a way that now when you get musicals like Sing 2, to me, at least, they seem relentless in working that formula? Do you know what I'm getting at with that? It just seems like it's really being pushed and really pushed. Brighter colors, bigger production numbers. Yes, Las Vegas in the sequel.
Yes, I think you are onto something with that. I mean, how can you make it stand out? Because I think one of the reasons these movies get made is to throw something in the ring for best animated feature. And in terms of that, I don't think this breaks any new ground in terms of animation. There's nothing in it where even, you know, as an observer, you know, not completely immersed in the movie, there were no moments where like, wow, that was a really good example of animation, or that really pushed the envelope or did something different, which, by the way, I think Raya, the Last Dragon, I think did do that, which I think edges it out in terms of awards. This is just a feel-good movie for people who like this kind of, you know, singing based movie. And I will say that, you know, the voice talent is pretty amazing. You know, the koala is Matthew McConaughey, and the pig is, you know, Reese Witherspoon, and the hedgehog is Scarlett Johansson. And of course, the main character that's trying to drag out of retirement to make the show go is Bono from U2. I always think that these people end up in these movies because they have kids and they want something they can bring their kids to that will impress their children. You know, they might not be impressed that you played Black Widow, but they would certainly be impressed that you were the voice of, you know, one of the characters. And if you don't look up who's in it first, it's a nice surprise. And you're like, I know that voice. And it makes the character likable even before you recognize who's in it. So this brings me to the idea of the early days of movies, where in order to be in the business, you had to be able to act, you had to be able to sing, you had to be able to dance, you had to be this all-around performer, because any one of those talents might be called into, you know, deployment for the movie. So I think it's sort of interesting, all those actors that I just named, you wouldn't necessarily associate them, except for Bono, with music. But there's a wonderful moment where Scarlett Johansson's character and Bono do a duet of a classic U2 song, and she's pretty good. So you find out some of your favorite actors have some singing chops. What do you think about that?
Marie, I think you're right. It's certainly a cast that we know, and to have them just vocally here, you're right, because it's a sequel, in some cases I knew going in who I was hearing. But what I oftentimes find is a point you made very well, namely that as you watch a film like this, sometimes there'll be other animated characters who are thinking, geez, who is that? Goodness, I don't quite recognize. And then that's one reason to stay around, at least through the point where you get the end credits and they have the vocal talent listed, because that is a bit of a game, if you will, right? Like who you recognize and who you're kind of wondering about. And then sometimes it's a big name popping out. The other thing that you mentioned that I very much want to pick up on is these animated films are made, you know, certainly for children. I saw it with an audience with a lot of parents with very young kids and really, you know, kept with it. They really stayed with the film and enjoyed it. But the point I'm making here is that by increasingly, I mean, the last few decades, it seems, with animated features, it's adults going as much as adults with young kids. And Illumination, the studio that's behind this franchise, is best known for Despicable Me, Minions, and so on. And those are films that have big adult followings, not just the small fry. And the reason I'm picking up on this point from you, Maria, is that when you think about this film, to have Bono in it, you're absolutely right. Sometimes really big name actors or musicians will do a film like this because they have small kids. They want to make a film that their own kids can watch, right? Because their own films might be, if they're actors, might be R-rated, you know, and they want to make something their own kids can watch. Or a musician like Bono, you know, the kids, you know, whether they're in the theater audience or not for live shows is sort of a moot point at the moment, but just simply that you want to make a movie or something that your kids can enjoy. And I knew that Bono was in it, but still when he appeared, you know, or when that character appeared, it's still like a quote unquote surprise in the sense that you don't quite expect to have a musician of that caliber, of that renown, suddenly popping up. And it works because the character he plays is this reclusive rock star, kind of a rock god, if you will, who just doesn't want to be bothered. He lives in not so happy isolation. He wants to be left alone, but trying to get him involved in it. Once they pull him in, and that's kind of hokey in a way, but it works. And once they pull him into it and he finally does appear, you do kind of get caught up in the enthusiasm. Oh my goodness, it's the rock star appearing. And you know, and we're going to hear our favorite U2 songs, if you will. And Marie, the final point I'll pick up on that you made was that you don't typically think of Scarlett Johansson and some of the others in terms of, you know, musical talent, but they hold their own, don't they? I mean, they're actually quite good with him. And it gives the film a little more emotional substance in that stretch than I thought it would have. And just simply, I mean, we all have been listening to U2. We all, I mean, I've seen them live. We all know the music. And so to have it near the end of this film actually does send people out on a happy note, very much so.
Now, Nick Kroll plays Gunter in this. This is his seventh animated film after Sausage Party, First Sing, Captain Underpants, the first epic movie, The Secret Life of Pets 2, The Addams Family, and The Addams Family 2. And the reason I mention that is because the zaniness in those other movies comes into this one at unexpected parts. And there were some really funny moments that I didn't see coming. Miss Crawley's eyeball that is not connected to her body and ends up, you know, being a wheel at one point. There were some really funny moments in this that I thought actually worked. One thing I wanted to ask you about, though, was the Bono character is named Clay Calloway. And I know that this is meant to be a tribute to the real life musician Cab Calloway. And I'm going to give you a chance to tell everybody who Cab Calloway is. But I wanted to ask you if you thought that was a miss in terms of the audience, because you and I might know who Cab Calloway is because of our, you know, ridiculous immersion into movies. But I feel like that is something that's like my mother's generation would be more likely to know that allusion. What do you think?
Well, you know, you make an extremely good point there, namely that, you know, if you get the reference, it's enjoyable, it makes you smile. I think it frankly would fly by a lot of people. And it's not their fault. It's just simply that we're going back to an earlier period in showbiz history. I actually saw Cab Calloway perform live once, and he performed one of his most famous numbers, the Reefer Song. This goes back to the early 1930s. It's a song about marijuana and how he dreamed about a reefer 9 feet long. And so he really, you know, wearing his zoot suit and striding across the stage and singing the Reefer Song. He was a great performer. He grew up in Baltimore, still has some family in the area. I knew his daughter over the years. And so, you know, I've had a little bit of connection that way to him. But when you go back to the big band era, when you go back to the 30s and 40s in particular, and he pops up in Hollywood jukebox musicals in that decade, both in feature-length films and in the short films that would be put together and, you know, shown before a feature. Cab Calloway is a fairly regular presence there. But back to what you were observing, you know, even though he's like really famous from that period in American entertainment history, most viewers today wouldn't necessarily have reason to be aware of him or think about him. And so fundamentally to what you're saying, I think you're right. It's a missed opportunity in the sense that, yeah, it's kind of built into the name of the character and the performative aspect, but as a performer, well, it doesn't quite work for a few reasons. One is just simply that I think you would need to nudge a little bit more in terms of who this is meant to be. Secondly, the fact that Bono as a performer has virtually nothing in common with Cab Calloway. If you think about the type of music, you think about the stage persona, they are like really apples and oranges. You know what I mean? Not just historically, but just in terms of performative qualities. There's just nothing connecting them really. And so to me, it was frankly kind of distracting ultimately. I thought they probably would have been better off just giving him some Joe Smith name or something, you know, just call him anything else, but don't remind me of Cab Calloway, whom I'm familiar with. And I'm realizing, well, Bono's not like him. And, you know, 99.9% of the people watching this film either A, won't pick up on the reference, or B, won't care. It's just sort of distracting. So let me throw it back to you on this one. Sometimes a film like this, I think, in the cultural mix, maybe tries to mix a little too much in. You know what I'm getting at? Like, it's a little arbitrary after all. You'd be better off actually saying, do we really need this? It's a sort of idea that it would occur to the creative team. And maybe they should, like, on second thought, think, you know what? We don't have to have this. It's kind of distracting. Let's just, like, hone in on you too. Why not remind us more of you too, rather than of Cab Calloway?
Yeah, I agree. I think that is actually right on the money, Mike. I think you hit that nail right on the head. I will mention one other thing that's in there for the adults is Scarlett Johansson's character at one point talking about how she's being underpaid and she's, you know, standing up for, you know, her right to make the money that she should make. And, you know, if you followed the whole Black Widow saga, you know, there was a moment where she did have to do that to try to, you know, recoup what she thought she was going to make when they released it on streaming. So I always enjoy when that kind of real life thing gets in there because it's like a little aside for people who are paying attention. But that brings us to our second movie, which is Swan Song, which you can stream on Apple TV. Mike, I'm assuming you saw it in the theater?
I did.
How was the turnout for that? Were there a lot of people in the theater?
You know, it's I hesitate in the sense that at the screening I went to, there were only a few people, and the film itself hasn't done all that much business. It's a small film because of the conditions we're living through. You know, people are either not going to see it or they'll be reluctant to see it in the theater. So the short answer is it's not really a big audience draw, a big audience film, at least in terms of how it opened. But to jump to the film itself, it has a really good science fiction premise. And why don't I hand it back to you at this point? Because, you know, so much in sci-fi depends on what's the premise for your film and then how's it handled. So I could pontificate for, you know, 2 hours right now, but let me toss it back to you. Talk a bit about the premise and why I assume you agree with me that it's actually a good idea for a film.
It is a great idea for a film. And this is my kind of movie where there's an ethical dilemma that you have to sort of resolve. And the fact that there's science fiction involved means, you know, you can sort of play with an idea that's not here yet. But what if it was? And here's the idea. What if there was a company that could make a believable clone of you and you realized that you had a deadly disease, you were going to survive, and you wanted to seamlessly provide for your family some way to keep going as if you never left? But you can't tell them that this is a clone. It's all very hush-hush. So you have to make this decision about whether realistic version of you would, first of all, trick your family. And would you want to put them in the situation of, you know, your clone kind of going on after you have passed? So that's the premise. And of course, that brings up all kinds of ideas about cloning and all those dilemmas of how real is it? And is that really enough like you that it would be worthwhile?
Yeah, you know, what's so nice about that is the fact that as you're watching it, those are big philosophical questions, and they really hold you all through the film. Now, the film works because of the premise, because of the central performance. You know, it really does hold your interest there. And let me get back to you on this one here, because I think we should talk about it significantly, not just in terms of the premise, but in terms of that central performance, because it seems to me that you need an actor who is not only good as himself, but also good as himself. I don't know. Yeah, after a while, you wonder how to even phrase this, right? You know, you're going to play yourself, and then you're going to play like another version of yourself. You can imagine what the story conferences must be. Yeah, I would love to be like sitting around the table when they do what they call the table read. Like, and now you're yourself, but the other self.
Well, the central performance is Mahershala Ali, and he has been nominated for Best Actor for the Golden Globes. I think he's certainly going to be nominated for the Academy Award for this performance because he is extraordinary. He's always good. But in this, you just really see him agonizing over this decision. You see these wonderful scenes with him and his wife, who's played by Naomi Harris. And she talks about how devastated she would be if anything happened to him. She wouldn't be able to go on. And so this also sort of plays into his decision that well, maybe I don't have to really be gone. Maybe she wouldn't know and she wouldn't have to go through this agony of doing without me. And they do these wonderful things, but they flash back to the way they met and all of that kind of thing. So you really are bought into the whole idea of, well, I mean, who doesn't want to stick around? They also, by the way, there's a wonderful performance by Awkwafina, who plays another character who has gone through the same dilemma, made a decision, and then is sort of watching it play out. Because even though you have your clone, you know, you're still alive until the day you actually pass. So depending on how much time you have left, there is a period of time for some people who opt into this to watch their doppelganger, which again, I think is just such a fascinating idea to play with. By the way, I did think Glenn Close, she has a small role as a doctor in this or scientist in this company that makes the clones. I didn't think it really made the most of Glenn Close, but I think everybody else in it did a wonderful job with this dilemma. And I also wanted to mention that this seems to be an idea that has taken hold in terms of storylines, because it reminded me a little bit of the Tom Hanks movie that came out this year, last year, Finch, where he has a dog that he wants taken care of after he has passed and has a humanoid character that he's created and is wants to sort of pick up where he leaves off when he passes. The problem with that is that in that movie specifically is, how do you make a humanoid clone of yourself convince anybody who would really know? And of course, with dogs, it's all instinctual. You know, you can't really do mind games with the dog the way you could with a human being. And for the dog, you know, you can only think as a human being, well, you know, no matter how realistic this fake you is, the dog's always going to know the difference between a clone and a real human being, and will easily go bond with another human being. So I just brought that up to mention, same sort of idea, different dilemmas.
Well, those are really good observations there. Let me reprise some things here. We both agree that the premise is really strong. We both agree that the central performance by Ali is really very, very good. Should I say performance or performances, however we describe what the actor's doing there. Let me state a few reservations I had about the film, because I enjoyed it, but it wasn't like totally winning me over. One is a point you mentioned, Marie, namely that Glenn Close plays, you know, an executive at this company, which is located in this secluded place, and there's an aura of mystery about it, actually, as to how it operates as a business. And this leads me to my reservations. Number one is what you mentioned. Yes, Glenn Close is always appreciated to see her on screen. Here, it was frankly kind of distracting. It was just like I'm pulled into the story and I think, oh, the first time I saw, oh, that's Glenn Close, you know, and it sort of took me off. And that might be me just thinking, here's a famous face. But still, her character doesn't amount to much. It's sort of a very quick and easy performance on her part. She's got to look severe, as in serious, but also concerned. You know, she's got that, and she does that really well, but it just sort of hits that button and that's what you get. And it's not really developed much beyond that. So that was distracting for me. In that same respect, in terms of the company that she runs, the service they perform, I don't know how to describe it even. Mahershala Ali plays a character named Cameron, who's a graphic designer. Why do I mention the occupation? Well, this is a guy who's doing well. When you look at his house and you look at his office and all, this guy's doing well. I mean, he's making some money, right? But he's not a billionaire, right? He's not loaded with money. So why do I mention that? Well, when he gets sick and decides he'll take advantage of this cloning process, all sorts of questions were raised for me. And I realize I'm being very pragmatic and just very much, you know, oh, come on, you're being too much of a stickler for realism or quote unquote realism. But yes, this nagged at me. It bothered me, actually. And number one, in terms of the medical process itself, the film is so extremely vague about it that I have no idea how this is done. I have no idea how they actually do this. You sort of get very quick scenes at the lab, if I can describe it that way. But even in a typical Frankenstein movie, at least to have a few more jolts of electricity or, you know, some lightning overhead, or, you know, there's something to quote unquote explain it. Here they don't even bother. Now, I'm admittedly waffling on this. I'm going back and forth. To what extent could you explain it? To what extent would you want to explain it? Should it just be a given that this is a process that works? But honestly, within myself, I kept having these quasi-scientific questions like, how exactly do they do this? What's the process like? And that was actually sort of bothering me after a while, that the film just sort of ignores that, just flies right by it. Secondly, and this is again a very kind of pragmatic observation, how much does this operation cost and who's paying for it? Now, this is something that is totally ignored in the film. Would his insurance policy pick up on it? And would they keep the secret as to what he's doing? Marie, let me toss this back to you, because I realize I'm asking very much, I'm saying, quote unquote, like rational, realistic questions or quibbles. But as the film went on, I found myself getting kind of like obsessed with these things. Like, I'm enjoying the film, and again, that central performance, but my goodness, he's like one of only several people at this facility. You know, who pays the light bill? And what exactly are they doing in that operating room? And all those things. The script basically just ignores all that.
Well, it did remind me of other movies. There's a scene in the place where they do the cloning. It's this sort of, you know, bucolic scene and a clinical, sterile-looking environment, which reminded me of Soylent Green, which made me think, all right, is there some edge here? Are we going to find out? It's all, these people don't have a dread disease. They've been tricked because, you know, it's scientific, you know, experimentation, and that, you know, didn't go anywhere. But I was fascinated by the idea that you meet your own clone, and you sort of try to make sure that, you know, you fill in all of the things that they need to know. The idea of coming face-to-face with your clone, I really interesting idea that they could have done more with. I also think they could have done more with the idea of the fact that you are tricking the people that you love. They kind of glance over. I think that could have been more of the meat of the story. Sure, it's great to think, what if you didn't have to say goodbye? But the people that you're not saying goodbye to don't know that you're actually gone. This seems like a crucial breach of honesty within a relationship that's supposed to be so good, you wouldn't want to cause them any pain. I thought that was the central flaw.
Marie, that also bothered me a great deal. It's such an ethical dilemma here as to how to handle it. And the way they handle it is, in effect, to deceive the wife, the family, the friends, whatever. And it's, and I was, you know, is it a happy ending? Well, it's all premised on deception. And Marie, again, this is an area where the film, I mean, it's a very thorny issue. How do you resolve this? But the film just basically ignores that, doesn't it? It doesn't really get into that at all. It just assumes that this is the course to take.
It was also interesting that they didn't go for what I thought would be the horror movie aspect, which would be that your clone rises up and kills you, like in The Stepford Wives, where they make a version of you that's so believable that it then has enough intelligence, even though it's a robot of sorts, to realize that you're a threat to their autonomy and believability. So I was sort of also waiting for that to, some sort of Stepford Wives or, oh, the law of unintended consequences just kicked in. And now we see why this should be only done under the most extreme circumstances. Although I can't really think of a justifiable scenario.
Well, there's a gentler humanism at work in this film. And for that reason, unfortunately, I think it glosses over all of the reservations that you and I have just voiced. It just kind of smooths all that over. So you're going to deceive your spouse. You're going to undertake this mysterious transformation, which is not going to be explained, but there it is. It happens. To me, those are all easy outs. The film really should be a more difficult, more troubling film than it is. It is troubling in some ways, but it does tend to gloss over everything you and I are talking about just now. It's just not there. It just gets smoothed over like it's not an issue.
Now, having said all of those things and all those reservations, I still recommend that people watch it, if only for that central performance by Mahershala Ali. And like I said, I think he will be nominated, if not win, the Academy Award for this performance. Which brings us to the end of this episode. Don't forget to check out our other episodes, which you can find at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And you can also find us under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora.
And we will see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.